Good day, everyone. This is Brenda speaking. Welcome to the IRP IoT Consolidation Working Group call on the 8th of December, 2020 at 1700 UTC. This meeting is recorded. Kindly state your name before speaking for the record and keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking. Attendance is collected from the Zoom room. And please note that Helen and Sam have sent regrets. And with that, I'll turn the call over to Susan. Thank you.
Lovely. Thanks very much, Brenda. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining. As I said, we're a really small group. I don't particularly want to stand on ceremony. If we need to, and if people are sort of naturally putting hands up, then fine. But if the conversation is flowing nicely, there's only sort of four or five of us, let's just chip in. In terms of what we cover, it's a very kind of high level agenda that I just quickly circulated. But basically, I thought we should just go back over what we discussed last week. Not to redo the discussion, but I tried to capture in sort of summary form where I think we came out on the particular questions that Liz had circulated about the emergency panelist role. But I would like to, sort of sense check that with you all to make sure that I've sort of reflected where you think we came out as well. And in doing that, I did identify a couple of areas where I wasn't sure that we'd necessarily covered things off. So I think that's probably, sensible to try and sort of finish that exercise off. And then we can move on to the Rule 7 markup and some of the other open items and hopefully make a bit more progress. But I think we made, really good progress on the last call. So, hopefully we can continue to do so. And Brenda's very kindly put my very last minute email up in the Zoom window so that we've got it. And I think everyone's in Zoom, so that's handy. So in terms of the particular questions that Liz had posed, I mean, the first was, as you can see, number one was, to whom should the request be made in the absence of an IRP panel and a standing panel? And we, I believe, came out on the call last time feeling that we should follow the ICDR rules. So essentially that the request should be made to the ICDR as the administrator of the proceedings. And I'm not sure, what I wasn't sure of or didn't think what we'd necessarily covered was once we do have a standing panel in place, we hadn't specifically covered off where the request gets made then, but my assumption would be, and I wanted to sense check it with you all, was that it would still be made to the ICDR as the administrator of the proceedings. It's just that at that point, the ICDR would be calling down an emergency panelist from the standing panel. But in sort of administratively, my assumption would be that unless there's an emergency panelist already having been put in place for some other reason, that it would be, the request would go to the ICDR and they would sort of take it from there. So I'm just going to pause and see whether that makes sense to everyone else or whether I'm completely nuts. And Christina's saying it makes sense. Okay. All right. So, I mean, we'll just, as I say, I don't think we need to spend hours on this. So we'll just, move on to the next one, if that's okay with everyone. So number two, and I was busy trying to scroll down and realized I can't because I'm not controlling this, but thank you. Okay. Thanks, Christina. Although we'll certainly miss you if you're not able to talk much, but completely understood. And for you all, I have a slightly hyperactive puppy going around, so I've got my headphones on, but if he gets himself into trouble, I may have to vanish briefly to extract him from whatever he's doing. Scott's asking us, what's the difference between the ICDR and the IRP provider? I don't think there is one, Scott. Liz will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that, I mean, the term IRP provider, I guess, is the more appropriate one, since at some point in the future, I guess, could change the provider. But I believe, you know, the ICDR is the IRP provider as things currently stand. And so I suppose in that sense, I think they're one and the same at the moment. In theory, I suppose it could change. That could be quite interesting if it changed. I'm not sure that there's any expectation that it would do. Scott, you've also got your hand up. I don't know if it's about that or something different.
Yeah, just real quick, because in going through what you provided for today's discussion, there did seem to be a few places where it looked like it was inconsistent. I can flag those, I guess, but I mean, just even in the first line, there's a procedures offer shall be appointed from the standing panel and sort of compelled by whom, and I put in by the IRP provider or by the ICDR to consider any question. And that's what brought up my concern, because there are places where it's used interchangeably, and I don't know that it's been defined as such, or if the definition needs to take into consideration the possibility of it being someone other than ICDR. That's the reason I raised the question.
Yeah.
Hi, it's Liz. Thanks, Liz. Clarify. The bylaws specify that the term IRP provider, and I can't recall what year it was, but the ICAM board approved that the IP provider would be the ICDR. So to your point, Susan, I think maybe, I don't know, but is there a possibility that down the line the board could then approve that someone else becomes the IRP provider? That certainly is a possibility. The ICDR is not written into the bylaws. That's a board action. To address that point about whether or not it's defined somewhere, if memory serves correctly, I believe that we do define the IRP ICDR as the board appointed IRP provider earlier on in the supplementary procedures. I think one either in the definition section or somewhere in the early paragraph of the rule. I hope that addresses the confusion.
Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Liz. And just to add, sorry, Scott, I'm just cutting you off. Yes, in not sure, I think it's definitions is clause one. Yes, you're absolutely right. ICDR is defined as having been designated and approved by the board as the provider under Article 4, Section 4.3.
Should we keep it ICDR in each place, or should we keep it, which is the defined term, ICDR or IRP provider?
I think ICDR is defined in the supplemental rules, which are obviously the ones that we are kind of replacing. But the bylaws have IRP provider.
I'm just trying to get something that's consistent, because I think going back and forth, it creates an ambiguity or uncertainty.
Sure.
Rules use ICDR throughout. So I would, and if we're relying on specifically ICDR's rule and we define ICDR as the IRP provider, then, you know, my vote would be that we use ICDR throughout the rules once we've defined it.
Thanks, Liz. I think I'd probably agree with that as well. And in any of it, you know, if the provider changed, then we'd have to look, you know, someone would have to look at the rules again anyway, because it would have, you know, an impact overall. Yeah. Christina's reminding us that there's undoubtedly going to be some kind of cleanup once this is all done. And I think that's right. Is that okay for now, Scott?
Yeah, that's fine. But I think that cleanup sometimes just doesn't happen when we keep going and keep going. And so I just think it's important to point it out along the way. And that perhaps will be enough of a pin for right now.
Yeah, thank you. And as Liz is saying, we, you know, throughout these rules, actually, ICDR is being referenced. So I think that's fine. Cool. Okay, so number two was how should the emergency panelists be selected from the standing panel? And when we discussed this, our conclusion was that we felt it should just be the standing panelists should sort of take it in turns to, you know, on rotation, basically. And so, you know, the next one in line would just be drawn down to be the emergency panelist as you know, their turn came up, unless they, for some reason, they were in a position of conflict and couldn't do it. And we also briefly discussed and agreed that we felt that being an emergency panelist on one IRP shouldn't preclude you from being a panelist, like in the full panel on a different IRP at the same time. And indeed, you know, if ICAM was having a particularly busy time of IRPs, that could well be the case that that happens. So again, you know, brief pause in case I've mischaracterized or anyone thinks I've missed anything. Okay, not hearing anything. We can move on to three. Should they be empowered to modify or vacate their orders? Currently, our rules are silent on this, but the ICDR gives that kind of power to its emergency arbitrators. And again, this is one where we felt that it seemed appropriate to us that emergency panelists should be able to modify and vacate their orders. I think it was Liz pointed out to us that the ICDR rules aren't very specific about requiring a rationale for that sort of a decision, although there's a general expectation that reasons be given. And so we felt probably this would be an area where perhaps we want to be more specific and actually make it clear that if they're making those kind of decisions, that they would give a rationale for it. Again, just quick pause. All right, number four. So number four is one where I'm not sure that we entirely concluded that. So I'm perhaps actually going to go on to number five first, and then we can circle back. So number five was about whether the emergency panelist could also serve on the IRP panel for the same case. So, you know, as the actual three-person panel is put in place, could one of those three people be the emergency panelist? And we did have quite a bit of discussion about this. We considered the fact that the ICDR rules have a general prohibition on this unless all the parties consent. We did have a bit of discussion about some concerns that if it was permitted, that there might be a concern, or at least a perceived concern, that an emergency panelist might get sort of influenced by financial considerations, you know, by the hope that if they kind of made the right decision for someone, that they would get to stay on the full panel. But overall, we kind of reached the conclusion that we felt that if we have a sort of general prohibition, unless all the parties consent, that probably addresses that concern. And I think we did feel that an outright prohibition without the prospect of the parties agreeing to have the emergency panelists stay on might be too, you know, might not be in the best interests of the proceedings, both because we're anticipating that the standing panel may be a relatively small number of potential panelists, probably, you know, potentially only seven. And, you know, also that potentially the emergency panelist might have the particular expertise that's most appropriate for a case, or where all the parties feel that they've, sort of been educated up on the background to the dispute and would actually like them to stay on. But we certainly did want to make to ensure that that it was something that that all of the parties had control over, and so, you know, it couldn't happen if one of the parties was unhappy about it. So again, just a quick pause to see if that reflects what you all recall and agree. Okay, not hearing anything. So then we can go back to number four, which we started talking about when is the emergency panelist's authority terminated, but we sort of morphed into a discussion on five, which is why I'm not convinced we totally put this one to bed, but this is one where I'd love to hear if others have a better recollection than me or better notes than I do. So in terms of when it's their author authority is terminated, I think we generally, I think we're feeling that they should stay in place until the IRP panel, the three-person panel, is constituted. But then there was a sort of discussion about, you know, or rather there was a question raised about, well, what happens if there are two panelists selected, but the third hasn't been agreed on yet? And that's where we started talking about, could the emergency panelist be that third person? I think to my mind, it seems to me that if you've got two panelists, but you haven't got the third yet, then you don't have your IRP panel constituted. And so it seems to me that the emergency panelists should keep acting, assuming there are any questions that they need to make decisions on. And they only stand down once the three-person panel is in place, even if, you know, whether that three-person panel includes them or doesn't include them. And so I think that would be my response to that question. Again, just pausing first of all to see if anyone disagrees with that. Christina's agreeing, so that's helpful.
Hi, Susan. It's Lizzie for the record.
Yeah.
Can I jump in here?
Yes.
I do agree with what you're saying as well. I also wanted to flag that I think it would be good for us to keep in mind that once, if we have a standing panel in place, I think this process of the third panelist being selected will, for all three panelists, and including the third one being selected, would go fairly quick, because under the bylaws, it's each party chooses one panelist, and then the two panelists that have been selected will choose the third panelist. And I think it's a little bit different from where we are right now, because a lot of the work that goes into seating the IRP panel relates to the fact that we don't have a standing panel. So you do have this period of time when you need it. You certainly need the emergency panelists who will stay in place for might be quite a long period of time, of months, before the IRP panel itself is seated. But I think that once the standing panel is in place, this process of seating the IRP panel will go fairly fast. So I think the period, the tenure of the emergency panelists might be pretty short.
Thanks, Liz. Yeah, let's hope so. Let's definitely hope so. I was looking quickly back at the rules, and I came across a bit which talks about what might happen if there are so many proceedings underway that the standing panel can't take another one on. And in that scenario, I think you go back to the kind of old way of doing things, whereby the parties are, you know, picking their own arbitrators, and so I think there's a sort of theoretical possibility that if the IRP process becomes extremely busy, that we might end up back in the old and slow process. But obviously, hopefully that, you know, doesn't come to pass, and we don't need to be, you know, it doesn't need to be like, you know, we don't need to worry about it, but just in case kind of thing. Yes. Okay. So hopefully then we have our emergency panelist in place until they're not needed anymore. And hopefully that isn't a very long period of time. And then there was, again, there was the other question that came up when we were starting to talk about this question for last time around was whether we need to address when a party can challenge a decision of the emergency panelist to the full panel. And would be interested in thoughts on that. I'm trying to think of obviously we've got the emergency panelists, as far as I know, are addressing questions of consolidation, intervention and participation as amicus. They, I think in our minds would now be also considering things like translation requests and indeed requests for kind of interim relief to the extent that any of those need to happen before we've got the full panel in place. I think the general feeling was that you know the emergency panelist is kind of empowered to be making decisions, and we want them to be doing so. In the context of consolidation, intervention, and participation as an amicus, it seemed, just off speaking off the top of my head, if a decision has been made by an emergency panelist to allow that form of consolidation or intervention, it would seem problematic to then have the full panel reversing that decision. Perhaps more problematic than the reverse, where an application has been refused. And someone wanted to make the same request again, but to the full panel. But sort of having allowed a party to participate for a short period of time and then sort of throwing them back out of the proceedings seems problematic to me. What if anything do you all think about that? If anything.
Hi, this is Scott Austin for the record. I think it's really hard to project, factual scenarios that could compel that. I guess one question would be, is what happens if something was submitted that was fraudulent to the emergency panelist, and this doesn't come to light until after that panelist has already, finished their work, and is whether their authority is terminated based on the course of time, or that is the constituting of the new panel, the full panel, or whether it's because something else has occurred that that they're no longer needed. They've finished their particular role. They've given a report, etc. So I don't know if it's fraud or something like that. Should the standing panel then be able to reverse that order? Or should it just be taken into account when they render their decision?
Thanks, Scott. And I can see Christina's also commenting in the chat that if we were to allow that kind of thing, she's feeling that the standard would need to be quite high, sort of a clearly erroneous standard, unless there was some sort of fraudulent conflict or conflict of interest. Maybe we want to build something in to that effect then, that generally speaking, we would, we would only be wanting those decisions from the emergency panelists to be overturned either way, if they been a clearly erroneous decision, or fraudulent conduct or conflict of interest. And I guess ultimately that's going to be a decision then that the three-person full panel is making. You know, the application would be made to them, and then it would be for them to determine whether they feel it's a circumstance where that kind of standard is met that makes it appropriate to reopen something that obviously has already been determined and will have been acted upon. Okay. All right. That sounds good. Well, let's see what else we've got. A couple more messages. Scott's agreeing to that. Ooh, okay. Another one for Christina. Another potential option, which eliminates the need for appeal, but could be rather messy, is to require the full panel for the proceeding once in place to ratify the emergency panelists' actions. And that ratification would be pro forma, except for the types of exceptions noted above. Yeah, that's also an option. Again, interested in the thoughts of Scott and Liz on that. And indeed, to some extent, it's a shame Helen isn't here. I'm sort of that calls to mind the concerns that Helen had expressed about her experience in the proceedings she's been involved in, where their procedures officer, as they are called currently, seem to feel a lack of empowerment and essentially to be parking decisions for the full panel to make. And I wonder if expecting the full panel to ratify things has something of the same impact of encouraging them not to make a decision. Scott is asking if the ICDR rules speak to this, and I am not sure, but I'm going to see if I can. If I can work that, I'm not sure if that's covered in the note that Liz had very kindly done for us, but I will just have a quick look and see. Not sure that it's in that note. I think I'd have to.
It's Liz.
Oh, thanks.
I don't recall that it does, but I'm going to check really quick with the ICDR rules, but I don't recall that it does speak to it.
No. Okay. I'm going to make a note as well in case we need to double check that.
So the ICDR rules speak to the fact that once the IRP panel has been seated, it has the power to reconsider, modify, or vacate the award of the emergency panelists. But it doesn't talk about the panel, the step of the panel validating the order of the emergency panelists.
Okay. Okay, but it does have the concept of the full panel put, you know, setting aside the decision or changing it revoking or vacating it. Okay,
that's right.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, certainly, you know, certainly we have the power to do that. It still seems reasonable to me to be setting a sort of high bar for the panelists, for the panel to do that. And presumably no reason why we can't. So yeah, look, perhaps we could, perhaps for present purposes, let's kind of assume that that's the path we're tending towards, if you like. We need to sense check this with the full group anyway, so we, you know, there's nothing we decide is set in stone. Oh, thank you, Christina. Christina's going to play out a scenario for us and report back. That sounds great. Thank you. All right. So that's where we got to with the set of considerations on the emergency panelists that we went through last time. Moving on, then, I think there were, as I flagged, there were various other issues which are sort of highlighted in the markup of Rule 7, but in summary are, you know, considerations about the time limits for the various applications, and particularly whether we think it's the same time limit for all of them. And I think, you know, certainly my feeling is that realistically, you know, when you're consolidating, you've got two existing actions, and therefore it's perhaps a much easier application to make to ask to be consolidated. There's less background work and less documentation to some extent to put together than the other two applications. And so perhaps it's appropriate to allow a bit more time for applications to intervene and applications to participate as an amicus. So I think that's one. And when we come to the rule, we can look at this more easily as sort of when the timing should run from. And I personally feel it needs to be publication of the IRP that you're seeking to join. There, you know, that's the point at which the world at large is aware that the IRP has been commenced and is underway. And so I think rather than the date on which it's commenced, which, you know, publication happens relatively quickly, but there could be a small time delay. And so I think from publication, but again, looking to discuss that. We've been talking a bit about panel anyway, but we do just need to set some rules or agree the rules for the appointment of the panel, including in particular if there's already a panel in place in the action that's being joined. You know, whether they stay in place or whether there are circumstances where they would step down. I think we have talked about this a little bit in the context of the full IOT, and probably felt that obviously there might be situations of conflict of interest, but the question is, are there any other circumstances that where we think we should have the panelists standing down? And then are there any additional factors? This is probably the big one, really. Number nine is are there any, you know, additional factors we need to specify in terms of what needs to be considered when determining one of these applications? 10 is who's able to participate as an amicus as of right, and then one regarding documents and access to evidence when you're an amicus. So don't feel particularly strongly about how we address them. Perhaps we should, since we've been spending quite a bit of time talking about panelists, perhaps it makes sense to sort of dive into number 8 first of all, and then we can circle back to some of the others. But if we could, Brenda, could we call up the markup document?
Yep, give me 1 second, please.
Sure.
This one. Is that the right one?
Yeah, thank you.
Perfect. You're welcome.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to go to my copy just so I can find the bit I wanted to refer to. This is hopefully, unfortunately, it's always quite challenging to see the actual comments, which is a shame, but nonetheless. So I think it is, yeah, the first one is paragraph 4, which is the timing. Oh, there you go. The timing for an application to consolidate. And so just as a reminder, that's where consolidation is, where you've got two existing IRP proceedings, presumably, one being earlier than the other, and either both of those, the parties in both of those proceedings wish to consolidate them together, or indeed one of them wishes to be consolidated into the other. But so the question is, sort of what is the timing for bringing an action for consolidation? And what I proposed in the straw person markup is what you can see here, which is a suggestion of sort of 15 days from the publication of the later IRP. Although, welcome other thoughts, I think we do in any event need to think about timings holistically. I think we've talked about that before, but nonetheless it's helpful to try and get something down. And proposed publication, as I mentioned, rather than what we have in the current supplementary procedures, which talks about initiation of proceedings. And as I said, I think whilst I think the notice of proceedings having been initiated gets published pretty quickly, if you're in a scenario where there are, perhaps as few as 15 days to do something, then losing even one day is significant. So that's why I was proposing from publication instead. But yeah. Oh, and sorry, Christina, I've been burbling away and I didn't see your hand.
Okay. Sorry. I find it to be very useful, so I wouldn't call it burbling. A few questions/comments. In this question, I've kind of been struggling with, and maybe someone else knows what the answer is. But it seems to me that you could have a scenario where you have another potential IRP claimant who, instead of intervening, decides it's more to their advantage to actually file their own proceeding and then request consolidation. In part because intervening I think there are some kind of different, it seems to me at least that there are some distinct procedural advantages to doing it as a consolidation as opposed to intervening. And in that case, if that is permitted, and I guess that's my first question, or is it in fact the case that if a potential claimant hasn't actually initiated their IRP at the time that the other proceeding with which they'd like to be consolidated has been published, is intervention their only option? But depending upon how that question is answered, it seems to me that if it's possible for a potential claimant to initiate their own proceeding and then request consolidation, I would think that we might want to toggle with that timing, the 15 days. I think there are also separate reasons why you would want to, as a practical matter, make that 15 days a little longer. I'm not entirely comfortable with, but 15 seems too short, because it would seem to me that as a practical matter, in most cases, a party isn't going to request consolidation unless they, quite frankly, have already at least reached out to the other claimant to find out, you know, are you going to fight this? Will you support it, et cetera? And that can take a little bit of time. As to what starts the clock, the easy way I think to solve this is to say either the, you know, filing of the notice of IRP or publication of the later IRP on ICANN's website, whichever is later. And that way, you know, you've got a little wiggle room, because you could certainly see a circumstance in which there's a couple days difference, or it could be the same, you know.
Thanks, Christina. Yes, you've raised a really interesting question, which when I've been trying to think about this, I have been slightly struggling to get my head around, you know, whether we're anticipating that both parties, you know, either party participating in either set of IRP might be able to make this request for consolidation, in which case the sort of scenario that you're referring to could come about, i.e. rather than intervening, someone chooses to commence and then request consolidation, or whether we're really anticipating that the only party who's making a request for consolidation is the first claimant, because they see a later IRP having been filed and think it's more appropriate for them to be joined together. And I don't know the answer to that. I can see benefits to that latter scenario, because it avoids your scenario there. But I can also imagine that you might have a situation where you're coming up against your time limit. And if you were to make your application for intervention, by the time that gets decided, you're out of time to file your IRP or something like that. Or indeed that the parties might both be kind of underway with their separate actions, and then, you know, only decide at a later point that they you know, it becomes clear to them that they ought to consolidate. I'm hoping I've got Scott and Liz now, so I'm hoping you two can shed some light on both of those thoughts. Thank you. Scott.
Thank you, Susan. Scott Austin for the record. Listen, I don't know about shedding light right just yet. One thing that Christina said that I think is important is dealing with the time frame. And I don't know if the 15 days got put in there just as a placekeeper originally, because I remember I made some changes early on when I really just wanted to see something put in that would start discussion. And I don't know if that's this section or not, but here's my question. The publication, we keep referring to publication, is that in a, I mean, when I think of publication, I think of the Official Gazette. I think of, you know, certain things that, that come up in the area of the SEC or things like that, tax notices. Where is the publication occurring? And is it something that the broad range of folks involved in our IRP proceedings would be flagging or be aware of for, you know, and I don't know exactly what that is. Perhaps Liz can enlighten me. But I'm just questioning whether, you know, typically people have watch notices and things like that. I don't know if that applies in this context, but how public or how conspicuous is this publication? Is it something, because I think 15 days is short as well, but I don't know if the next move is to 20, to 25, to 30, and what's reasonable under the circumstances of who would be obtaining notice or be interested in receiving notice of what's published.
Thanks, Scott. I'll go to Liz now because she's got her hand up, and I suspect she'll answer that as well. But Liz.
Thanks, Susan. So let me start off by addressing Scott's question, what it means with publication. The publication is when the once an IRP filing has been perfected, which means that not only has the claimant filed the notice of intent to file an IRP, but has also filed their opening brief and as well pay the fees to initiate an IRP, then we get notified, ICANN gets notified by the ICDR, then ICANN within, I would say, 24 hours or 48 hours, depending on the lengthy exhibits that might have been filed and what needs to be scrubbed in terms of any confidential or personal data that has to be scrubbed before it gets published. We will publish it on the IRP webpage that is on ICANN.org. And usually it's very visible, it's very public, and I think most people will have some kind of watch list, as I understand it, how they follow what has been filed. We also have on that page a status chart that gets updated, which shows which IRPs have been filed, what the date is, what's the status of that IRP, as well as also on that chart talks about CEP. So generally in the past, what my understanding parties have done is they're tracking to see traditionally people go from CEP into IRP if they can't resolve their claims. And so people track it that way and they can see what CEP has ended and then if it's gone into an IRP. So I hope that addresses that question. And just thinking about the example that Christina raised, I guess one thing I wonder is that in terms of the timing of things, and if somebody wants to file an IRP and then after filing, move to consolidate just to have the advantage, whatever that might be, of filing an IRP instead of seeking to consolidate or intervene. I don't know that there would be necessarily that much of an overlap in terms of time or that much of a delay in terms of time from filing an IRP to moving to consolidate. I mean, presumably the party is running up against a deadline, like say it's 15 days, what have you. If they want to file an IRP first, I would imagine that they would want to add the request to consolidate at the end of their, as part of their opening brief, or if not, like shortly thereafter. So, I mean, it's not certainly not a decision that they probably had made at the last minute once they've seen the other party file an IRP on the same subject matter. So that's just something to take into consideration. That said, I understand it from ICANN.org standpoint, if the 15 days might seem to be an instance of too short of time, and we might want to talk about the impact on weekends or holidays onto that 15-day, we want to consider that. And if it makes more sense to add a few days or a few more days to the time frame, that works. But I do want to flag that, you know, keep in mind that the bylaws also specify that IRP should be resolved within six months. So, you know, we should consider that in terms of how much time we add to allow so that it's not ends up being too long of a period of time impacts the resolution period for the IRP. Thanks.
Thanks, Liz. Okay, and with sincere apologies, I missed a little bit of what you were saying, although so I will ask you a quick question. In terms of in terms of the concept of whether there's a reason to restrict whether you can you know whether you can bring an IRP when and then immediately ask to consolidate, or whether at that point you should only be in a position of intervening. Apologies, I'm not sure if you addressed that, but I'm afraid I missed it.
I'm sorry, are you asking whether or not the rules allow or we should allow a party to move to consolidate after they've filed an IRP?
Yeah, I just that the notion of if you file an IRP and immediately ask to consolidate, you know, whether there's any particular reason to say that in that circumstance they were already aware of the previous proceedings and so they're procedurally they should have asked to intervene rather than commencing their own separate IRP. Can you see any reason? I mean, do you have views on that one way or the other?
I think from a processing standpoint, that's the one instance that we had a consolidation so far. That is exactly what happened. And in terms of how that those two IRPs were decided in terms of timing and efficiency, it wasn't an issue of consolidation or intervention. I mean, in that case, ICDR is the one who initiated the consolidation once both parties have filed and the parties agreed to it. So I think taking that example and applying it here, if the parties agree to it and they continue to operate under the same, the streamlining things and the IRT is resolved in an efficient and manner, I don't see it off the top of my head right now. I don't see a disadvantage to it. I can't think of a reason why somebody, I can't think of the advantages that someone would want to file instead of move to intervene. But that said, I'm not seeing any kind of a prejudice to either party if they file and then they move to consolidate, as long as we are respecting the time frame, the timing as set under the rules, you know.
Thanks, Liz.
I guess, I'm sorry, let me just add, I guess we would, in that case, though, I think that if someone were allowed to file first and then move to consolidate, we might want to think about adding provisions and our rules that specify their timing in which they would have to move to consolidate, because we don't want a situation where we go down the path of them, say they're seeking interim relief, and so this, the the emergency panelist selection and the IRP standing panel selection, or sorry, the IRP panel selection is undergoing before they move to consolidate, because then I think that would be an inefficient use of time and resources.
Yeah. Thank you. So, yes, I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, I think that's why when I had put in this wording in what's now called numbered paragraph four, I think that's why I was suggesting that the timing ran from the publication of the later IRP. And I guess that would impact both of them. So whether it's 15 days or something longer, and whichever party is asking for consolidation, suggesting it, that timing runs from the later one, and therefore they've only got a finite period, having filed that later IRP, in which to request to consolidate. But perhaps if you're the later IRP proceedings, do we feel that we should be stricter still and say that in as the commencer of the later IRP, do we want to impose an obligation that you make your request to consolidate at the same time as filing your IRP? Or does that seem unduly constraining? I kind of feel it is, provided that there's a reasonable time frame. And apology, I'm so sorry. I just have to go and let the puppy out, but I will be right back. I'm double muted as well. Sorry, I'm back. Did anyone have strong thoughts on that? Liz?
Hi, Susan. It's Liz. I guess the question is, if we are doing this, if we do allow for the public, for the 15 days from the publication of the later IRP and allow parties to consolidate by filing first and then consolidating as opposed to intervening, does that encourage parties then to be able to delay and play with the timing more, so to speak? I mean, if you have, for example, a strict time, say 15 days from the filing of an IRP to be able to file a motion to intervene, but if you want to consolidate and you or motion to consolidate, or you can file your own motion to consolidate, I'm sorry, your own IRP, and then move to consolidate, you're afforded more time, so to speak, by doing the second option. If that makes sense.
Yeah. But I suppose you run the risk, don't you? Again, sorry, Christina, I'm just speaking out. I'm sort of thinking out loud. In that scenario, though, don't you run the risk that you're allowing the other action to proceed in your absence, or throughout this period, while you're playing around with the timings, and that that then the panel may well take the view that you've, it's too late and too much has happened and it's not appropriate to consolidate because the first IRP is too far down the line. Question query. Christina.
Sure. A few things. First, I think we can possibly address this by making clear that the time clock runs, and the language obviously gets a little tricky, but make it clear that the time clock for requesting consolidation runs from the publication of the IRP with which the other IRP will be consolidated, whether it's the earlier filed or the later filed. I think you'd still, because that then gives you the flexibility where you have the second claimant in time being able to request consolidation. Making clear, the next thing would be to make clear that the if a potential IRP claimant has not yet filed its IRP as of the date, that they're not barred from requesting consolidation and are not then required to intervene instead. If they hadn't filed its IRP as of the earlier filed IRP's publication date, as long as they otherwise meet the timer requirement. And third, and I think this might address Liz's question, and quite frankly, I think it'll make it easier to administer. I am just generally of the view that the timing, whether it's for consolidation, whether it's for intervention or request to participate as amicus, whatever day number we decide on should be the same for all three. Because otherwise I do think that you run that risk of potential manipulation.
Okay. All right. And I just want to make sure I understood you correctly. I think I understood you to be saying you think that the timing should run from the date of publication or let's use that terminology for now because it's easiest, from the date of publication of whichever action it is you're trying to participate in. So whether that's a consolidation or an intervention or whatever. So
exactly.
Yeah. So if you're the first filer and you want to consolidate into a later filed action, then it's from the date of the publication of that later filed action. But if you're the second filer, for want of a better term, then you've got to hit the time frame for consolidation into that earlier action. And if you can't, then it's down to the discretion, if effectively.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That does make sense.
And that's part of the reason I think we need to make it a little longer than 15 days. Because you very well could have a situation in which a potential claimant's like, you know, I was planning to file in a month, but now I need to meet this 15-day clock. I've made the determination that I'd rather have my own proceeding and have it consolidated versus being an intervener. So, you know, but there's no way I can get my complaint finalized or my request for IRP finalized and filed in 15 days. So that's part of what's driving my, let's make that a little bit longer. But yes, you captured what I was thinking completely. And I guess my question then is for Liz, does that address the concerns that you had flagged?
I think so. I think so. I think it addresses my concerns. We'll have to see it once we actually put pen to paper, but I think it does address that, and I like the idea of making the time period all the same.
Yeah. Yes, and I think that makes more sense as well. I'd been envisaging it, as I think I said, I'd been envisaging it as kind of you have more to think about if you haven't already commenced your proceedings, but you're right, I think, that it's certainly simpler for everyone, isn't it? And as Liz has been saying, it's not as though an IRP comes out of the blue. It's even if you're not involved in the action, you've got a certain level of awareness of the existence and nature of the dispute and they almost always would go to CEP, cooperative engagement process. That's absolutely encouraged under the bylaws. And I think, as we've seen in generally speaking in proceedings, that certainly is the case. So in fact, you know, it's not as though you may not be fully aware of the timing of when a CEP might come to conclusion or whatever, but it's not as though this is all coming out of the blue. Okay. I must say, it's not clear to me why you would, if you hadn't already commenced your action, it's not clear to me why you would choose to bring your own IRP instead of just intervening, because it doesn't seem to me, certainly as currently envisaged, it doesn't seem as though it's a different test, or you know, different circumstances where you'd be granted that ability to be involved. Indeed, I think probably the only scenario I can envisage where you might want to do it is where you're coming up against your time limit to bring your IRP, and if you're concerned that by applying to intervene, you might run out of time if that application got turned down. But other than that, I mean, I guess it's up to the parties, isn't it, that they may well perceive a benefit that I can't perceive. And so we don't necessarily want to shut that off from them. But I can't, yeah, as I say, I can't quite see why you wouldn't just intervene instead, since it puts you in, as far as I can see, the exact same position. Okay. All right. So 15 days, I guess we should at least talk about that. And just before we do, Liz, is there a general understanding in kind of the ICANN world that if a time period is sort of under a week, that then it's working days? But if it's over a week, then it doesn't exclude sort of weekends, or does that not, is it always calendar days? In any event, if it's 15 days, I assume it's always calendar days.
Right. For the most part, it's calendar days. Where we've counted business days has been specified in under the bylaws that it would be business days and not calendar days. But the default is calendar days.
Okay. Okay. And so then I think we need to be mindful that that under the bylaws, at least, you know, there's this anticipation of IRP proceedings being wrapped up in 6 months. Even if, you know, we're all aware that is so frequently not the case. But I think we have to bear that kind of bylaws desire in mind when we're giving the amount of time for one of these applications to participate. So I'm kind of agree with the comments from that have, you know, noted 15 days and felt that it's too short, but I, you know, we have to be mindful that there's theoretically only 6 months to play with. With that in mind, and again, I think we have built in a kind of general discretion where it seems appropriate for the panel to allow longer. But does 21 days seem reasonable, or 28? I don't think we could go beyond 28, really, could we? Because you know, as I say, the proceedings are meant to be wrapped up in 6 months. Scott.
Well, I wasn't sure if we had addressed yet. Someone had said the question of calendar days versus business days, holidays, if any of that counting is defined or provided for in another section. I guess that I wasn't sure if we'd address that yet. I think if we address that, maybe some of the question about whether it's 21 or 28, I still think 15 is too short. But then the question is, you know, could we just move to 21 days if we have business days versus calendar days?
Yeah, Scott, I think what I took from what Liz said was that it's, generally speaking, unless it says otherwise, it's calendar days. So right. the current time period that we've got in there is, well, and I don't know if the current supplemental rules even have a time period, but you know, as currently envisaged here, the 15 days is calendar days.
Well, if there can't be a carve out for business days for a particular section, then it makes sense to me that it, maybe you move from 21 to 28 to provide.
I mean, I think we can say business days if we want to, but the challenge that we have with that, I would imagine, is that because people are all over the world, and you know, my business days are not the same as the business days in sort of Israel or the Middle East. So I guess that's probably why it's easier not to try to account for business days. And calendar days gives a greater certainty. In which case I'm hearing you say you'd favor 28.
Yeah, I think that if we need a little bit more time than what's there, I don't know. We arrived at multiples of seven suddenly. I would think that you'd want a little bit more time. But if I'm not disagreeable with 21, I mean, that's six more days is from what is there. But I'd be interested in hearing others' thoughts on, you know, favoring 21 versus 28.
Yeah. I don't think we could go beyond 28. 28 seems fair to me. But I could get behind 21 as well. Any thoughts, Christina?
I actually have a question for Liz. Have there been any IRPs filed that are subject to these new bylaws? In other words, does the 6-month requirement actually apply to any pending IRP proceeding?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. And the web IRP. Huh. And also the main chief IRP. But obviously,
they're way over for both.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I'm just kind of wondering, like, I for whatever reason, I'd never focused on that 6 months. And I just, mm-hmm. as somebody who went, 15 months, it just strikes me as overly optimistic.
Right. Yeah, I thought Flip had said it was more honored in the breach than it was
yeah.
as well.
I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, the existing IRPs that are under these new bylaws are coming in, then they're nowhere near going to come in at 6 months. I mean, I think they're both over 6 months already, and they, you know, aren't even at hearings. Well, Web has had a hearing now, hasn't it? But it, you know, it's been going on for ages. But you know, on the one hand, it's all very well for us to say, well, that 6 months is never met. But you know, if we draft rules that you know, kind of make it impossible, then we're adding to that. So whilst I kind of personally view the bylaws as being, as you say, wholly optimistic, at the same time, I kind of feel like it's our job in drafting the rules to at least attempt to assist the parties in meeting the deadline. Liz?
So I just did a really quick search of the current supplementary procedures, and I do want to flag that there's one instance when we talk about timing that was measured. It's measured in business days, and that's with respect to the time to an IRP being deemed effectively timely filed, and which states all fees must be paid to the ICDR within 3 business days. And then you have the business days being as measured by the ICDR.
Okay, thank you. Yeah,
so, I mean, that's something if we want to go that way. But I tend to agree that if we are going to add in, if we account for business day or we account for holiday, that makes it very difficult given, you know, the reasons that you noted about different, it means different things to different people around the world.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I think that's not, I don't necessarily think the fact that's allowed for in the case of a very short time frame. There seems to, you know, to my mind that it's kind of reasonable and it's quite common, I think, in contracts for that kind of situation where, you know, if it's a really short time frame of just a kind of couple of days, that, you know, you don't want to have basically taken out the prospect of meeting it by putting a weekend in the middle of that short time frame, whereas that doesn't come into play quite so clearly when the time frame is something that's, you know, a couple of weeks or longer. I think the calendar gives everyone more certainty than you know, having to work out which business day we're all talking about. Christina.
Sure. First, I agree with you on calendar days. I think it's just going to be cleaner. And second, I think this is one where it almost doesn't matter if we recommend 21 or 28, which is, I think, our two options, because this is one where I think we absolutely know that the full group is going to have fairly strongly held views on this. So maybe in the interest of just kind of considering this a semi-completed action item, we just do it as 21/28 and make sure that when we're discussing it with the broader group, we flag kind of the struggle that we were having in deciding as between the two. Namely, you know, is 21 days really enough? But on the other hand, if we go with 28 under this new 6-month recommendation, because I did see that it should and not must in the bylaws, you know, we're effectively extending the length of the proceeding by 15% off the bat. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Christina. As always, a really sensible suggestion. So thanks for that. Yeah, I think we can do that. Okay. And yes, that kind of does bring us to having sort of agreed on this provision, at least. It's kind of 23 minutes after by the clock here. I am very mindful that I'm bad at overrunning on time. And I've also just done ICANN's chairing skills webinar, which has exhorted me again to be more mindful of timing. And therefore, I think we should stop at this point rather than start looking at something new, a new fresh provision, where we will then inevitably run on. So perhaps we should just quickly, obviously there's a limited group of us here, but we should quickly talk about our next call in terms of when it should be. If we are to stick with the 2 weekly timing and rotating with the full working group calls, then the next one would be on the 22nd of December, and it would be the 1900 UTC time slot. That works fine for me, in terms of it being the kind of week before Christmas. It's not a problem from my perspective, but keen to hear from you all, you know, including you, Liz. I don't know, for example, when ICANN is kind of closing its doors for the Christmas period. So I just want to check in and see. Yeah, Christina's saying it's not as though she's traveling. Yeah, you're right. Sadly, me too. I have nowhere to go and can't go anywhere. But so I'm happy to meet on the 22nd if others are. But obviously, if in fact ICANN would be closing down on that date or before that date, then I don't want to schedule a call that's inconvenient for everyone.
ICANN doesn't shut down until the 24th.
Okay. Well, shall we assume that we're going to have one? I'm noting Bernard's comment in the chat that after the 20th, you can sometimes get quite poor attendance, but I think, you know, we may all find that we're more available this year than we usually are. And it's looking like maybe Brenda has an issue. Brenda, why don't you see, and if it's something that can conveniently be covered, then perhaps let's schedule a call and see, and if we get lots of people refusing the invitation, then we can reconsider. But you know, if it's actually really difficult for you to find Yvette or someone else to cover, then you know, I'll reconsider. So is that okay if we assume for now that we'll do it on the 22nd? But if, you know, if it's not possible to get staff cover, or if everyone starts rejecting their calendar invite, we can reconsider.
I'll get a calendar invite for you. No problem.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All righty. Good. Well, thank you very much, everyone. And obviously really happy if anyone wants to look at any of this and put in suggestions by email in the intervening period, that would be super. But otherwise, we'll all reconvene for the full working group next week, and then hopefully for this group the week after. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Christina. Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Liz. Thanks, Bernard and Brenda. We can wrap up.
Thank you, Susan.
Bye all.
Thank you. Bye.